TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.
Welcome back to A Change in Attitude, the podcast that takes a look back at the Attitude Era of WWF and realises how terrible it actually was. I am Mags, and I'm joined on today's show by the wonderful, the original, often imitated, never duplicated, Ori, the only draw. Ori, how are you?
I am good. How are you, my friend?
Yes, I'm doing good. Had a nice understated Christmas, plenty of food, plenty of good times, and spent with the family. Yourself?
The same. Not as much food as we normally do. It was nice and quiet and understated. We're sadly in the middle of the Omarion surge here in Louisiana. That's what I'm calling it. The Omarion surge. Nobody can say it right, which I think is the funniest thing.
What's the Omarion surge?
Instead of Omicron?
Ah!
Omegatron? Okay. Yeah.
We are hit bad with that in the UK. I've just read today that the top 25 areas of the UK hit the worst of it are all in Danny's neck of the woods, all down there in that dirty London.
Yikes. Yikes. Yeah, it's not. We've got over 500 people hospitalized here currently as of, I believe, yesterday. Almost, I think, a little over 18,000 tests and at least 1,400 to 1,500 new cases. Oof. Two of them being family members of mine, and one of them's my stepdad, and who's currently going through cancer treatments. And so that's frightening. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to take, as many precautions as we could. We're not 100% sure, nobody over here, we could be asymptomatic, but none of us have shown any type of symptoms. But we took as many precautions as we could. And so we're being very, very careful. My mother-in-law has already had it once, we're all vaxxed up and whatnot. But still, just a really concerning situation. But Christmas in and of itself was good. We're recording in that weird week between Christmas and New Year's.
The void.
Yeah, that nobody knows really what day it is or where they are or what's happening. But, you're kind of in that weird space in work where it's like, I don't really want to do anything. But we're getting it together and making it through and looking at this pay-per-view. Ugh.
Oh, well, I mean, we'll get into it. We may not share the same viewpoints on it, but on a serious note, I've got everything crossed for you, for your family members, everyone. Thank you. With the COVID variant, hopefully. It's proving to be maybe not as deadly as previous variants, but a lot more kind of infectious. So hopefully people can get over it quickly and get the booster jabs and make sure that they are doing all that they can to keep themselves safe. But we're not going on this terrible journey into a WWF 1996 pay-per-view alone, returning again and leading this episode, which is going to be fun. It's Kent's very own Scottish juggalo himself, Danny. Danny, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you, guys, for having me on yet again. And I'm excited to get into this pay-per-view.
Yep. So how was your Christmas?
Oh, pretty good. Yeah, pretty quiet. Just usual. Just around my sisters and things like that. And then just spending time with Denise, which I always enjoy.
Oh, cool. So, yeah, Dan, did you want to take the reins in this episode?
Yep. So today we're going to be looking at WWF In Your House, It's Time, which with no Vader, which is I found very strange.
It still sounds so weird.
It is weird. It's totally weird.
It's just one of those things, I guess. But where was Vader at this time? Did anyone
he was still with the company, and he certainly wasn't injured. The aim of this show was for him to be defending his title. But obviously, at SummerSlam a few months ago, Shawn Michaels did have done a Shawn Michaels and politicked his way to not dropping the title.
And supposedly, Vader was injured from the match, I believe, at Survivor Series from Yokozuna. Mm-hmm. Mm. That's the angle that they're playing, anyway.
That's the kayfabe run. But yeah, essentially, this was meant to be Vader's kind of come out as champion, but Shawn Michaels put the kibosh onto that. But some quick facts about it. This was held at the West Palm Beach Auditorium in Florida on December the 15th, 1996, so in the run-up to Christmas. And the attendance was actually a capacity of 5,708. And if you're looking for it on the Peacock, I'm sure Ori has the numbers.
I do. And I will tell you, this one's a little bit more difficult to find. What you'll need to do when you get to the WWE section is go down to pay-per-view specials. They're not going to list them all in that little rolling left to right scroll. If you press to the left, that will allow you to view all. You can scroll down and go directly to In Your House. And then from there, it'll be season 2, episode 7. I had a little trouble finding it, and that's why I'm giving you all of this direction, because if you just try and go to that general left to right scroll on the initial WWE page, you're not going to find it there. You'll have to press left, and then that view all button will come up, and it'll give it to you more in a four row grid pattern. And so then you can scroll down from there and find In Your House. And like I said, season 2, episode 7.
Yeah. Very, very convoluted on that Peacock app. I think we're very lucky to still have the actual WWE network here in the UK. Although there is talk that Peacock are going to launch in the UK very, very soon. And they're probably
then you can suffer along with me.
But after that, Danny, take it away, sir.
Yep. So to open up, we had a really good opening package, which highlighted the main event and Mankind versus Undertaker versus the Executioner. What did you think about this opener? I thought it was very 1999.
Yeah, it's it shows that WWE even back then were still good at these kind of like promotional packages. It focused on Shawn Michaels, which was a little bit interesting. Supposed to say was not really involved in the match, and we also kind of see that later on in the show where this isn't a lot to do with Shawn Michaels, but yet he's still massively involved to the point where he winds Bret Hart up. But yeah, it was a very well done WWF package for me.
And then at the end of the package, of course, we're told that Shawn Michaels will be out at ringside for commentary for that main event match. I mean, you know, like you said, even back in these early days of the Attitude Era where things were really kicking off, or maybe we should say re-kicking off for the WWE coming back around, you know, because I feel like there's cycles, you know, WWE has these cycles where they're very much popular and then they kind of fall out of popularity and it goes back and forth. And a lot of that I think has to do with how they're booking their talent, how they're playing out these storylines. But even back in these early days of the Attitude Era, they really did have a good concept on how to build these packages to make them seem interesting and make you want to look into it. Matter of fact, I feel like their packages are better than their overall storytelling in some cases. And this is definitely one of those.
Yeah, fully agreed. So from there, we go to the first match of the night, which is Leaf Cassidy versus Flash Funk. And this, for me, this was a really good opener. There was a few spots missed and things like that, but it was still pretty good. What did you guys think of the opener?
I thought it was really good. It's very much the technical wrestler versus the high impact, high flyer trope of wrestling match that we've seen time and time again. That, like you said, there were some missed spots, but I'll be honest with you. Something about those missed spots, like, for example, when Flash Funk goes to try and jump on that top rope and misses with one leg. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's sometimes when you have those missed spots that it's just, oh, that's really bad. Somebody could have gotten hurt. But I feel like for some reason in this case, in this specific match, when that happened, it didn't detract from the match. It made it more realistic, kind of like when you go to a boxing match and a boxer goes to make a big swing and they miss or they don't hit exactly the right target that they mean to hit. You know, the competitor turns and they end up with a shot to the shoulder instead of into right directly into the jaw. So, it wasn't so bad that it was like, oh, God, he completely missed. It's like, okay, he's human. You know, it kind of normalized it a little bit. I'm one of those people that my wrestling doesn't have to be 100% perfectly pulled off all of the time. Yeah. And I feel like that both Leaf Cassidy and Flash Funk in this match, they didn't make a big deal of it. You know, they didn't overcorrect it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Yep. Because I feel like when you draw that much attention to it, whether it's on commentary or whether it's actually in the ring, it can make it feel a lot worse than it really is. They recovered from it really well and kept going. And anytime that, because I want to say that wasn't the only thing that there was some missed opportunities or things that didn't get pulled off quite right in that match, but they played it off very, very well. They used it to their advantage and it made it feel, you know, because we all know this is scripted. This is choreographed. You know, we're old enough to get this about this by now, but it gave it that little semblance of validity that this could be an actual fight between these two people. And I appreciated that about this match, but I absolutely agree. You know, I wasn't expecting this much out of this match. I wasn't expecting to be into it. And it did kind of start off really slow, but I found myself as the match went on enjoying it more and more. And I think it was a great opener. It was a great match to start the show with, to get people excited.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Totally agree. One thing that really stood out about this match for me though is why it happened in the first place. There was usually pay-per-views are made for matches that have a storyline built into them, so you kind of get the blow off. This has had no storyline build whatsoever. There was no real reason why these two would be fighting on a pay-per-view. So I actually did a little bit of a looking into why this was a pay-per-view match, because this, as good as it were, and I agree with everything Ori said, and you, Danny, that this was a great opener, a real kind of a high-octane technical versus half-layer style match, which really made for a good start to the pay-per-view. But it wasn't meant to be this match. This match was actually meant to have some sort of kind of continuation of the Billy and Bart Gunn storyline, where Leaf and Marty Jannetty were meant to kind of be involved in that match, but if you recall the when Leaf was coming out, it was mentioned that Leaf wants to have a singles career. So what that means is that Marty Jannetty had actually just been fired.
See, I missed that in the opener altogether, and I didn't feel like this match needed a reason other than to potentially push Flash Funk, because he was on a roll. I didn't question why it was happening, and that was okay. I feel like sometimes we over explain, fans, but like, you know, within the, you know, we always have to have a reason for a match. No, I don't think we do. And Leaf wants to have a singles career. That's fine, you know, but I don't think it added to or detracted from the match in any way.
Oh, no. I mean, for the match, it made absolutely no difference. It was a solid, solid opener. It's just got an interesting backstory. Marty had been fired because he and Leaf had actually complained about a recent match that they'd been in. So we know that the guns are split up, that Billy's turning heel. In a recent match, what was meant to happen was that Billy walked out on Bart, but Bart would beat the Rockers by himself. Marty and Leif Cassidy both had an issue with it, went to the booker, who was actually Jake Roberts at the time, and asked why Bart would win against the two. And it was said from Jake that this was so the guns didn't look like shit. So Al Snow, Leif Cassidy, asked Jake, said, "Well, what will that make us look like?" Jake didn't reply. So after a little bit of a standoff, they actually agreed to lose to Bart, which obviously we saw happen a few weeks ago. But neither of them was happy about it. Marty got fired for kicking up a stink, and Leif ended up becoming a nobber, I suppose. I mean, this match was still really good, but the reason why this was happening and not a Rockers versus Smoking Guns iteration was because they kicked off in backstage about having to do the job.
Wow. It makes sense. It does make sense because Leif and Marty aren't really doing much anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no reason to build them at this point. So, and if you're trying to continue that storyline and you want to make Bart look good up against Billy eventually when that, you know, head-to-head match takes place, whether or not Bart's going to be losing it, if you want to have him look strong, that he can look like he can potentially beat Billy, because that's Billy's whole shtick at this point, is I won the titles. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and I get where Jannetty and Al Snow are coming from. You don't want to look weak, you know, two guys against one. But for storyline purposes, as shitty as it is, it makes sense. And
you've also got to factor in the fact that Jannetty has had a history of having issues.
A whole different bag of cookies.
But it goes to show that maybe he couldn't, he wouldn't be trusted with a long-term kind of push up the card, and his role would always be to elevate somebody else in the feud. He wasn't happy with that. And obviously he went his own way, and Al kind of had to sit and bear the brunt of it.
Mm. Yeah. And that's the hard part. You know, it really kind of makes me feel for anyone who's paired with someone like that. Like, I get it. You want the big push, but you know, if they don't view you that way, then you're not going to get it, you know? And if you're paired with somebody like that, who's constantly, you know, upset, arguing, you know, then if something like this does happen and they're fired, then you're probably going to be looked at, well, his partner complained. Mm-hmm. We put them, you know, despite the fact that if the company put them together, that's what's going to happen. You're going to be viewed that same way until you're proven that you can sit down, shut up, and do the job. Yeah. You know, I mean, and that's my thing. Like, if it makes sense story-wise, you can complain all you want. There's not a problem with that. But you have to be prepared to see all sides of, you can't just look at the main dish on the plate. You've got to look at the sides and everything. And that's the really weirdest thing about this whole situation and this whole era of WWE or WWF at the time, because you've got things that are happening where you've got multiple side dishes going on in the midst of the main, you know, the meat of the plate. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But then you're complaining because you have people who aren't seeing the bigger picture, but then you have other storylines going on where there's so many other side dishes involved, it's hard to focus on that main portion of the course. Like, I don't freaking get it. It's the dichotomy is mind blowing. It's mind boggling. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, to get back to the match and kind of put a finality to it, I thought this was a great opener. And I agree with you, Ori, about the kind of like the missed spots and the botches, adding a sense of realism to the fight rather than be a choreographed dance. It looked like an actual fight. And what really piqued my interest was the way that Flash Funk got the finish. I mean, we've been used to seeing him do that that amazing kind of a somersault leg drop, but he didn't even do that in this match. It was the 450 splash, which is shows he can get a finish from absolutely anywhere. I think he was superb in this match. I think Leif Cassidy kind of transitioning away from that half-lying rockers gimmick to more of a technical wrestling. I mean, we see him doing belly-to-bellies and face-busters and stuff like that. I think this is a better position for both guys.
Definitely, especially considering where they are on the card. Mm-hmm. One thing I did notice about this match as well was that there was a small Flash chant as well, but other than that, the crowd kind of just was meh about it.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey folks, PC Tony here. Thanks to our new partnership with Angry Lemonade, you can save 10% on physical products and digital commissions using the promo code CHAIRSHOT. Head to angrylemonade.net to check out their amazing catalog of products and services. Use the promo code CHAIRSHOT to save 10%. That's angrylemonade.net.
But from there, we go for the tag team title match, which is Fake Razor and Fake Diesel versus Owen Hart and Bulldog. This match if you talk about crowd reaction, to me, this was dead. But what did you guys think?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think what kind of confused me was Diesel and Razor, inverted commas, haven't had the best of runs since their introduction into the company. So I don't get how they have made their way to the number one contender spot. But it's also a heel versus heel dynamic as well, because Owen Hart is definitely a heel. I mean, Bulldog is still on the heel side, but we're seeing kind of almost like a face turn with him and the Austin stuff. But this just, it felt a little bit confused. Like there were so many elements in it that it's almost like they threw as much shit at the wall to see what would stick. I mean, there's a point where we see two AAA wrestlers, I think it's Cybernetico and Pyroff, come to get involved. And then obviously Austin, I mean, this won't be the first time. The last time we see him and he gets involved. I mean, the inside of the stuff that happened in the ring wasn't that bad, and it's probably the best we've seen of Diesel and Razor in this kind of new iteration. Obviously, Owen can always have a great match with anybody, and Bulldog is certainly no slouch when it comes to his ring work. But yeah, it just felt confused to me. They were trying to sow more seeds of storylines that needed to be. I think if they'd have kind of simplified it a little bit, we may have got a much better match. But saying that, I don't think it was a bad match, surprisingly, considering two of the players in there at this time in the careers not good.
Definitely. Just before we go to Ori, I just want to say, did you catch Jim Ross's line about WCW in this match?
Go on.
Jim Ross says, and I quote, they're not, regarding Fake Razor and Fake Diesel, they're not bald or 45 or have artificial body parts, which is referenced in Roddy Piper's artificial hip. But yeah, I knew I was waiting for that WCW thing. But what did you think, Ori?
I thought once we actually got to the meat of the match and stopped having all these seeds that we're planting and sowing and trying to expand upon, once all that was out of the way, it was good. It was a decent match. You know, I thought Razor and Diesel looked fairly decent. Owen and Davey Boy always look great, just about. There's very few exceptions to that. I mean, first of all, we get these guys come in from AAA, which was shocking to me because I never knew that WWF had any type of working relationship with AAA. And more than likely, now, Mags, you'll have to correct me on this. Had WCW started that working relationship with New Japan at that point?
Not quite yet. It was certainly in the works, or but this wasn't a new thing for WWF at this time. When it gets to usually around Royal Rumble time, you'll see a smattering of foreign talent come in. Usually they use Carlos Colon's group CWC, but you usually see some CMLL guys come in, but it's only like over the last between 95 and 96 where AAA have been involved in Rumble. It's usually made to bulk out that Royal Rumble 30-man match.
And that makes sense. I mean, but it just blows my mind that they had these type of relationships when they're so hesitant to do it now. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, they now have large rosters with both Raw and SmackDown, and now they have NXT that they can pull from, or they have for the last, 8 years, give or take. So it's not super surprising. But at the same token, it's like, you've had these working relationships before without having to buy out an entire company to build your roster. Why is that not possible now? And it is, but Vince doesn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. He feels like he should be the be-all, end-all, and there's lots of people, I'm sure, in his company that feel that same way. You know, they want to be the number one spot for sports entertainment, and I get that. But that's part of what made the territory so good, was having other people from other territories come in and compete against your wrestlers. And I think that's why, you know, Ring of Honor and New Japan have done so well in the last couple of years. Why AEW is doing so well with having their working relationships with AAA. And I believe they also had one with CMLL for a hot minute. And now trying to further those or reestablish and reaffirm those relationships with New Japan and other companies, because it just puts more eyes on both products. You know, you get those crossover fans, people who are diehard Ring of Honor fans are going to watch New Japan, you know, diehard New Japan fans are going to watch AEW and vice versa. So it makes more sense. You know, you don't have to buy out and take over an entire company to make this work. It can be beneficial for everybody, but Vince doesn't want that. He only wants it to be beneficial for him. I'm sorry, that's my soapbox. It pisses me off. But yeah, we got the CMLL guys, and we got, you know, information AAA that guys. They would be, yeah, AAA guys. What did I say?
CMLL, they're mortal enemies.
You knew who I meant. We got the AAA guys out there and found out that they were going to be a part of the Royal Rumble. And then later on, we get Stone Cold Steve Austin coming out and attacks a British Bulldog. And they just go at it until they have to be ripped apart. And the thing that got me about that, like, I get it. There's already something going on there because of past actions. But Owen Hart just stands in the corner and says, focus on the match. Focus on the match. Really? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I know there's some type of, I guess, understanding between Hart and Austin, but still, like, I would be over there. Come on, man. Focus on the match. Something other than just standing in the ring corner at the ring post waiting to get tagged in. I don't know. I have a big problem with all of it. I feel like they could have left the AAA guys to do what they did. Maybe tease Stone Cold around the ring, do not have them match up at all, and then still do what they did at the end. Davey Boy and Owen Hart retain, and then Austin comes back out, chop blocks the knee, and takes him out. I think that would have worked a lot better, continued that little seed of storyline without disrupting from the whole match. Mm-hmm. But outside, like, once we got past the whole Austin and Davey Boy situation and got into the meat of the maybe I'm hungry. I keep talking about food. I think I should have eaten before this podcast. There's lots of food references today. But I think if they would have done that and left the chop block at the end when they were celebrating in, it would have gone over a lot better. Because once we got past all that, I really felt like this was a good match. It was a decent match. It was worth watching.
Yeah, you're certainly right, and the Austin and Owen stuff it can be a little bit confusing if you aren't fully aware and if you've like been missing Raws, but essentially their relationship is they are enemies who have a common enemy, so they're coming together. That common enemy being Bret Hart. Bulldog is he's kind of siding with Bret almost in terms of kind of saving him from Austin because enough's enough. I think he said that in a confrontation with Austin earlier. But the weird kind of almost issue between the tag champs is that Owen is never coming to save Bulldog. He's letting Austin hit him with chairs. He's letting Austin beat him down. And he's only getting involved once that beatdown is over. So it's showing there's chinks in the armor of these tag team champions. But you're right. And to continue the food puns, I think they're milking this storyline and it's getting a little bit cheesy now.
Good Lord.
What did you think about that pin that Davey Boy Smith? I've never seen that before in my life. Did you see the way he pinned the fake Razor?
It was an attempt at a roll up, I think.
But a bad attempt.
Yeah.
But straight from there, we go backstage where we see the Nation of Domination on a very 1996 laptops here.
Jesus Christ. This was horrid. Nobody in that group of the Nation of Domination looked like they had any clue what was going on. The two Eminem wannabes were just smiling, laughing, and throwing up hand signals. Farouk was nodding a lot. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
But I've got a fun question for both of you. What do you think was on their screen? What were they? I was going to say Googling, but Google wasn't there. What were they on AOL? What were they searching?
Sunny. Yeah, I mean, she's the most searched woman on the internet.
Probably. Sunny and Sable.
Yep, definitely.
I think they were blank. I don't even I think they were made to look like they were plugged in and there was nothing actually there.
But I'm just glad it, the it king was. No, go on.
I was just going to say. Go on.
Oh, no, I was going to say, just don't look at the king's internet history that night.
He definitely uses incognito mode a lot. But yeah,
he's the reason incognito mode was made because nobody needs to see that. No, I think somebody saw it by accident and went, nope. Yeah. We got to make a mode just for him.
This segment went way too long for me. I get going backstage and showing kind of like a bit of reality of what goes on, but the camera lingered on this group for way, way too long, to the point where it got awkward. It felt awkward. And then we obviously then go on to Vince in the ring. And I understand it was because Vince had to leave the commentary booth and get set up in the ring. So you're filling for time. But modern day
Not only that, you've got to get, because Clarence Mason is part of the Nation of Domination as well, but he was already at ringside with Davey Boy and Owen because he's part of that as well. So it's a combination of probably both of those things, trying to get Clarence Mason backstage, get him with the Nation of Domination, then also get Nation of Domination in place and where they need to be, get those mics set up, get Vince off of commentary and into the ring. It's a lot of moving parts. And I think, you know, this day and age, the way that things are, this match with that segment would not have been right behind each other.
No. And what would have made it easier is if months and months ago, Clarence Mason didn't force Jim Cornette on his deathbed to sign those contracts over.
Cornette probably in his head thought he was on his deathbed, let's be honest.
But regarding this this in-ring interview, all I can say is thank Christ for WWE Network subtitles, because I couldn't understand a thing Emma Johnson was saying.
But I will say the subtitles, the closed captioning was a little problematic at some point.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm kind of with you.
Yeah.
How bad did wrestling affect his life though? He's lost his home, he lost his car, he lost his girlfriend, he's lost his marbles, he's lost his faculties.
I don't know if he had those before, but he's still got that big gold chain around his neck, so he can't be doing too bad.
Yeah, exactly.
But he has no life. His life is over. His life was over when he started wrestling, because he does it for the fans. I will say, you know, as cheesy and kind of goofy as that was, in a way, it was still kind of endearing and sweet. I don't know why, but I think it really helped to put the fans behind him, because in this whole interaction, the thing that gets the biggest reaction is him starting that chant at the end.
Which felt cringy, though.
It did, but at the same time...
You're going down. You're going
did
down.
Did you hear how quick the audience picked up on it, though? So I think that was a good thing, because it showed that the fans still were behind Ahmed Johnson. They still, you know, despite some of his retaliation against Farouk that could potentially make him look like a heel, it firmly solidified Farouk in that heel position, and it firmly solidified that the fans were behind Ahmed Johnson. They did still want to see this match, and that he was still the face. And so while it's all kind of cringy to a point, it worked. It did what it needed to do, and it affirmed some things for the WWF at that time about that potential matchup. Because I think if that whole segment would have gone over much, much worse, we never would have seen this.
Yeah,
we wouldn't get that matchup. We wouldn't have a continuation of that storyline.
Definitely. And so from there we go to Mark Miro versus Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and to me this was the match of the night, but I'm really interested in hearing your guys' thoughts, especially regarding that video package as well, which was really well done. What did you guys think of this match?
It was well done, but it was done out of order, because if I remember correctly, you know, so they show the whole thing where Hunter enlists Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, and then he dismisses his servant. And I was like, wait a minute, didn't that happen before Hennig turned on Miro?
It did, but
okay, good. I wasn't my memory's not the greatest, but
in real life, Kurt had left the company by now, so they had to kind of like massage the facts to fit
around. They had to take some creative license.
But
that revisionist history that WWF is so good with.
Yeah, but one thing this video package did show is the bit that happened before we actually started this whole journey through the Attitude Era, and that's the part where Hunter actually brings Sable into the company, and it's Mark Mero who does the saving. That happened, I think, just before King of the Ring. So we kind of missed that little bit of addition to the storyline. I mean, we know about it, obviously. But yeah, again, another really well done video package for me, even though they did kind of massage the truth to make it fit.
No, you don't say. But overall, the package was good. This is where I had problems with the closed captioning, because they kept calling him Mark Merrill instead of Mark Marrow, like Merrill. How did I pick? Because I always watch with closed
captions. No, how did they not pick up on that? I mean, obviously somebody goes back to caption the shows afterwards. How did they not pick up on the captioning?
I have no idea.
I think they retired after that.
This is my thought process, okay? And I'm just coming up with this off the top of my head. The regular closed captioner was out sick that day, so they brought in someone who had no knowledge of the company, had no idea what was going on, because there were a lot of things that were said, especially towards the beginning of the championship match, or the end of the Undertaker match. the Armageddon match that were not closed captioned at all. There was a lot of skips in there. Granted, there's as there is normally with a WWE show, there's a lot of talking over quickly, you know, back and forth type, you know, conversation. And so it's kind of hard to get all that out very quickly and type that out. But it's like, really? But yeah, it said Meryl repeatedly. At no point did I ever see the closed captions actually say Mero, M-E-R-O. Wow. And so my thought, headcanon, as you were, is that the regular closed captioner for WWE was out sick that day.
But also, there was a really good line from Jim Ross again when just at the start of this match, when Hunter and Mark went up against each other face to face, Jim Ross blurted out the line, "They're nose to nose, which gives Helmsley the advantage." Obviously, taking a piss out of his large nose there. But
that's not the one that I thought you were going to come out with. I thought you were going to talk about how he was asking Vince if they were neighbors in Greenwich.
Oh yes.
Like, well, maybe they are now. Maybe Vince not at this point, but they're going to be soon.
His best to know sell that I noticed. I mean, just.
It is a big schnoz. I've seen it so in person. Mean. It's a very, he has a very prominent profile. We'll put it that way. With his pomposity.
Definitely. But as we get into the match, we see a Goldust run in here with, probably this was the best use of Goldust that I've seen during these couple of weeks I've been watching. I think he looked really strong here. What did you guys think of Goldust running?
So we do have to kind of take it back a little bit because apparently there was a match on the pre-show. Hunter Hearst Helmsley came out, said something to Marlena. Marlena got very offended. Nobody knows what he said. So apparently this is what prompted Goldust to come out at one point during the match. Triple H had gone, they had knocked out Earl Hebner, and Helmsley had gone for the belt, brought it into the ring. Mero and recovers, they tussle for a moment with Hebner down, and then they both end up on the outside with the belt in the ring. Goldust comes in, grabs it, attempts to hit Triple H, who ducks it. Goldust ends up hitting Mero by accident, but then turns around and hits his intended target of Hunter Hearst Helmsley, then drops the belt, walks back out. I can't disagree with you. It made sense. They built up and gave us enough information for anyone who missed the pre-show to justify Goldust coming out here. It was a quick in and out and done. He came out, did what he needed to do, and turned around and walked out. There wasn't a whole lot of lingering. I didn't dislike it at all. I thought Goldust looked great. I thought it was very strong of him. He didn't jabberjaw. He didn't, you know, "You've got more of that coming," or, you know, "Don't you ever speak disabled like that again." Blah, 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 blah. You know, there wasn't all that jaw jacking and stuff like that. He came in, took him out, turned around and left. And I think that was the perfect usage of interrupting a match, so to speak, without distracting completely from the match that they've done in quite a while.
I agree with you. I think it absolutely made sense. But my issue with it is that after the opener, it happens in every single match. We get interference, and it's almost diminishing returns when you go to the well so many times. But in this match, it certainly did make sense. And one thing I really did enjoy was we get the kind of start of that that love hate relationship between Triple H and Earl Hebner in this, where
Earl Paul Hebner.
Trips tries to kind of intimidate Earl. Earl's like pointing to his back saying, "Look, I'll throw the match out. I'm the referee. Respect me." And then there's a part where we're doing an abdominal stretch, and Hunter keeps grabbing the ropes, and we get the Earl kicking the arm of the ropes. Just something they'll revisit time and time again throughout throughout the career. But I thought that was a cool little kind of throwback.
Definitely. I just want to say one thing about the Earl Hebner Triple H thing. This obviously would go on until Earl Hebner left the company in 2005. But I hate this because I grew up playing those WWF games and WWE games on PlayStation, and they teach you from a young age referees are just subhuman, they're just nothing. And obviously watching early 2000s, referees are just disposable. So anytime a referee gets, he was dominating Triple H at one point. Triple H was cowering to him, and I really didn't like that. But
especially when he forced him into the corner, and Triple H actually literally sat down on the corner.
I couldn't believe it. I thought Triple H was definitely going to get a revenge, but no, it was he's just scared of Earl Hebner over here. But
yeah, it's kind of convoluted because, you know, on the one hand, Triple H seemed like, and they even make mention of it, that he's trying to get himself disqualified so that he doesn't lose the belt. But on the same hand, he's afraid of Earl Hebner because Earl might disqualify him or come after him. I don't know. I think there's good ways to play with the referee, because I do think referees are important. And I think that's why I enjoy Aubrey Edwards so much, is because she has a way of making herself feel important and vital to the match without completely detracting from it. And I know that there's a lot of people who will absolutely disagree with that. Mags looks like he's one of them. But I
like Aubrey Edwards. I just think she overacts sometimes to the point of ridiculousness.
But part of me kind of enjoys that, because watching her reactions, for me, it shows that she's just as much of a fan of what's happening as we are, you know. And I get that some of it is overacting, but I understand why she does it. On TV, it may come across as overacting and campy, but when you're in a stadium so large, one of the reasons why theater versus television is you act two very different ways, is because when you are in a theater, you want to project your voice and overact your motions because you want the person in the very back row to be able to see what you're doing. Versus on television, you have a camera sometimes right up on you. So you can make those tiny, minuscule actions, whether it's with your face or with your eyebrows or with the flick of a wrist, that a camera will pick up that a theater would not. And so I get why she's doing it. She's doing it for the benefit of the live crowd, but I get why people who typically watch via television think it's too much. You get what I'm saying? But I guess as someone who did a lot of theater growing up, I can see that. And I also did extra work. I had an agent. I was planning on becoming an actress at one point. So I get the dichotomy, and I understand where she's coming from and why she's doing what she's doing.
Don't make me get the monocle out.
Why would you need the monocle?
Oh, I was an actor.
No, it's not like that. I was an actor. No, I'm just saying I have this human experience that I understand and can share. Yeah. God, it's not me bragging. If I was bragging, I'd be like, well, you know,
back in the day,
I won an award for my acting. Which I did, actually, but that's neither here nor there.
But totally not bragging.
You know what? I will brag, because I did damn good in that show, and I was very proud of it. I was very proud, and that was the first year I was ever with that company. No, I'm not going to reel it in. You can make the fishing motions all you want. I am very proud of what I did.
Well, one thing that's...
Next episode, she's going to do an Owen Hart, come out with her Slammy Awards, walking around. I am not a nugget.
I should. Where's my damn award? Is it in the closet? I'm going to go pull it out of the closet, just so you can see it.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is your boy, Kenny Killer, telling you to make sure you check out TheChairShot.com, bringing you breaking news, interviews, podcasts galore, everything pro wrestling. Make sure you check it out, TheChairShot.com.
one thing that won't win an award was the finish of this match, which was, I'm never a fan of cheap finishes on pay-per-views. What did you think of this finish?
Yeah, I mean, Ori really explained it really well with the gold dust coming out. I never get the point of a wrestler when he's going for a title, not throwing his opponent back into the ring. It made no sense. So obviously that means that Mark wins the match, but doesn't come away with the title. But what that kind of leads to is a frustrated Mark Miro, and the hint maybe of a heel turn, because when Sable and Earl go to raise his arms, he's like, no, I'm not happy about this. And then to kind of show his frustration, he hits the wild thing, which he wasn't able to hit earlier in the match. So it makes sense if we are going down the path of Mark Miro becoming a heel. But yeah, I don't like schmozzy finishes like this.
Definitely. And from there, we go to a very good, in my opinion anyway, a good Sid Vicious interview with Michael Hayes, aka Doc Entrance.
It was good, but too quiet.
The audio was shit for this.
Yes,
and I don't know if I should blame it on the audio producer, whomever was working the audio. I don't know if I should blame it on the mics at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if I should blame it on Michael Hayes, who didn't get the microphone close enough to his face. Like that's another one of those TV versus theater type things where, like, I get what he's doing.
You won an award.
No, I get what he's trying to
back
do.
In my day, I won an
God
award for
it,
my
Mags.
Mic work.
Screw you, Mags. Where's Tanner? Bring Tanner back. We're going to kick you off and just bring Tanner back. Good God. No, I get what he's trying to do with the inflection of his voice, but because the mic, the actual portion that picks up his voice is down at his chest, it's not able to pick up that soft inflection that he's intending. It would have made more sense for... and I know hindsight's 2020, but for Sid to grab the mic from Hayes, even if it's still in Hayes' hand, grab his whole freaking hand, bring it up closer to his mouth so that we can catch that softer, menacing inflection that he was trying to do. It wasn't a bad interview, but because the audio missed that, even though we knew it was going on, like the closed captioning didn't pick it up at all. And so it would have made more sense for him to grab Michael Hayes' whole hand and just, I'm going to get right up on the mic and I'm going to menacingly inflect my voice, you know, that kind of thing. So
It
really kind of, made the whole thing shit the bed for me.
Yeah. And Sid has got this reputation of being terrible in live interviews. I mean, everybody knows about the I've got half the brains that you do interview, or the one where he tried to redo a live interview with Jim Ross. But one thing he's really, really good at is that loud shouting intensity, and then takes it all the way down to almost a whisper, but be more intense than he was when he shouted. It's such a great kind of a character work. And when he stiffens his upper lip so it's almost dead straight, and he's saying, I'm the ruler and master of the world. Yeah, he can sell that he is an absolute killer.
And it's not even that his lip is straight. Like, his lips don't move. His teeth don't move. It's almost like a ventriloquist act. And that's why I think that the closed captioning didn't pick it up, because it's straight up. His mouth ain't hardly moving. Those teeth ain't moving. They are clenched tight. But it's amazing. It's really amazing. And it's really a shame that the audio didn't pick it up the way that it was intended, because it was phenomenal. It really, really was. Those, I don't want to say dichotomy again. Somebody needs to get me a thesaurus. I need more words. But that influx.
I do words
that,
good.
Right? But that, I can't even think of the word that I'm looking for. But the
word's dichotomy.
It is. It really is. But I know there's another word that I can use. But that vast difference in influx of tone. It's amazing character work, and it works for him very, very well when he gets it right. And if the audio would have picked it up, it would have been phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal.
Definitely. It could have been his best interview ever. But something that we've all been dreading, to be honest with you, is next is The Undertaker versus The Executioner in an Armageddon Rules match. I think this is the only Armageddon Rules match that ever appeared.
I wonder why. So essentially, for people who haven't watched this show yet or haven't heard of an Armageddon Rules match, it's a last man standing match, but with a pin before it, essentially.
Or submission.
Yeah, or a submission.
Basically, there's no disqualifications, there's no countouts, but the opponent has to be pinned or submitted. And then once that happens, they have to the count of 10 to get up. So yeah, it's very much a last man standing type match with a pin. I think the premise of the match is really good. And it's surprising that they didn't bring it back with, you know, the Armageddon pay-per-view. But the way they pulled it all off went over like a turd in a punch bowl. Like, it was horrific. I don't even know how else to explain it. And I think some of that not only has to do with some of the things that went down in the match, but I also think that it had to do with the way some of the things were shot in the match for those of us at home. The camera work was terrible. Oh, they're going somewhere where we can't go with cameras. But all of a sudden, there's a camera out on the outside. And you can see Taker throwing execution. So outside, let me set this up for you. We get a couple of shots of the outside of this arena, right? And it looks like, you know what it reminds me of? Y'all may not get this, but our American viewers may. If you go to Disney World and they have the Carousel of Progress, which is essentially a stage show with animatronics, and you sit down and the stage itself never moves. You rotate around through different eras from the past, how technology has shaped the past into the present and how it can shape us into the future. It's literally one of my favorite rides at Disney World. I don't know why, but I love the idea of this ride. But the outside is shaped like a dome that is set down into a basin. And so Taker essentially takes Executioner, they go up the ramps and they go outside, and then outside of this weird inverted triangle is almost like a levee. It slants down and there's like a pond or some type of water feature.
I think it was a fountain, yeah.
Yeah, there's a fountain on one side, and then it almost looks like there's a bay behind them, or it goes out into the Gulf, maybe something like that. So Undertaker takes him outside. They're looking at the doors, going outside. There's fans running outside to see what's going on. And then all of a sudden, the camera that they have shooting outside to give you an outside view of the arena pans over, and Taker is throwing Executioner down this concrete ramp to the water feature and throws him in. Meanwhile, in the ring, Mankind has come out at some point. And then they send security out and they start macing him. And from nowhere comes a straitjacket that they tie him into.
It got ridiculous.
Absolutely. It was absolutely ridiculous. It was the nuttiest thing. Like, I don't even, like, I get it. It's Mankind. He's done some crazy stuff in Japan. He can, quote unquote, take the mace, you know. Technically, if that's what they were actually spraying, I'm assuming that they've made it sound like they sprayed him at least twice.
I bloody well hope it wasn't real mace. Look, Mick, this is going to sting a little bit.
Right, but at the same time, can you not see Mick Foley going, just spray the mace, it'll be fine.
I mean, I
had my ear ripped off. It'll be fine. I've lost my teeth. It's going to be fine. The mace is nothing. You know, I've been in a barbed wire rope match where the ring explodes. Like, this is nothing.
It puts mace on his cereal.
Especially in comparison to the things that we go on and see Mick Foley do. Like, I can see Mick Foley going straight up, Yeah, just hit me with the mace. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Just have some milk on standby. It'll be fine.
Yeah, but we spoke earlier about how the interferences in the matches gets a little bit diminishing returns. This match needed the interference. You can tell.
Absolutely.
Terry Gordy was not in the best of shape. Obviously, having real issues with his dalliances in his former career. Taker did his best to carry the match, but it needed Mankind to be involved because that was what the main feud was about. It was about Paul Bearer and Mankind. Executioner was just a tool to keep this feud going. But the match was just daft. I mean, we get to the point where we're using Mankind as essentially as a wrecking ball to destroy the set up at the top of the ramp. As Ori explained, we get the outside padding shot of Executioner rolling down a concrete hill into a puddle. We get security guards who all have the same T-shirt on, looking professional, but all with kind of Zubaz pants, which looks just ridiculous. Mankind getting maced, put in a straitjacket. Do the security guards have the authority to put someone in a straitjacket? What the hell is going on there? And eventually we get Undertaker coming back to hit the tombstone and get the win. So in terms of actual wrestling, there was nothing in this match at all. Probably a minute and a half of wrestling. It was all just filler to kind of stretch it out to keep the storyline with Mankind and Undertaker going, and to essentially just throw poor Terry Gordy into a freezing cold puddle of water. Ridiculous, but fun. I enjoyed watching it because of that ridiculousness.
I can't say the same. I really wanted to, and it was bad ridiculous. It wasn't funny ridiculousness. Like, for example, the exploding barbed wire match between Moxley and Omega, that was ridiculousness that I could laugh at, especially towards the end. And I know a lot of people had issues with that end, you know, but I could laugh at it. I could see through it. But this was not it. Not for me. You know, I get why you would find that hilarious because you're a very strange and unhinged individual. But
wow. Sorry, I haven't won a Tony Award for my performance on Broadway.
Well, neither have I.
Yet.
No, that'll never
just
happen.
Just Tony nominated.
No. Never will happen. But, you know, I can understand why you would see it that way. Because it was ridiculous to the point of absurdity. But I wasn't to the point of enjoying it for its ridiculousness. I was just like, it's too much of one thing and not enough of something else. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the discussions that we've had about, you know, the Undertaker Mankind storyline being a payoff in reverse, it really, this very much lent to that thought process where the bigger matches happened in the beginning and now they're paring down. And if it, because I don't have the, you know, the future knowledge of knowing where this goes, if it's cooling it down to a point to where it can be built back up, then yes, I'm here for it. I'm all for it. I don't see that at this point. I kind of hope for it because otherwise none of this makes sense. It's I don't like it. Oh, and I set off my Alexa by accident.
She's telling you the results of the next pay-per-view. That's right.
Okay, I guess.
This storyline doesn't go anywhere, Ori.
And it's absolute shit. Why are you watching this? Because I have to.
I think there was a good point made when I was reading some bits about this as well. It seemed that they tried to copy Roddy Piper Goldust Hollywood Backstreet Brawl earlier in the year at WrestleMania, but failed miserably here. I mean, just
very, very miserable.
But something that didn't fail, well, maybe it did, was this Bret Hart interview. And it was very telling because halfway during the interview, Shawn Michaels' music plays. And I think Bret Hart is really pissed off, but I couldn't tell if he was working or shooting there. But
it felt real.
That, yes, definitely. And that, to me, was WWF 1996/1997 in a nutshell, where Bret Hart's given a good interview only to be interrupted by the Heartbreak Kid. What did you think of this interview?
Yeah, it felt like it was starting as a typical Bret Hart interview. He tends to say a lot of the same things, run through his catchphrases, but when that Shawn Michaels music hit, he went off. He was fuming, absolutely fuming. So I think there was a little bit of shooting this, because clearly we're getting to the point where these two really have backstage heat. They really have like a personal rivalry. So I think it was very, very, very much a real thing. And I think this is the era where Russo's getting a little bit more kind of leeway with his booking. So he kind of lacks that reality-based stuff where you're getting instant reaction. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if he has set that up, because they could have easily brought out Shawn Michaels in between the matches, but not to have him come out during that interview, yeah, it pissed Bret off royally.
So here's my thing, okay? And this is just me spitballing here. What if it wasn't Shawn saying hit the music specifically to piss Bret off? What if it was Stone Cold? Because it makes sense in the fact that Stone Cold has this beef with Bret Hart, and part of Stone Cold's bitching has been, you're coming out here interrupting my interviews. You're asking me about so-and-so, Bret Hart, when it's my interview time. You're going to their house, but you got to fly me all the way to Connecticut to do an interview, but you can interview them at home. You know, furthering, because we got to remember, while Stone Cold is not technically on this card at all, he's still a major player in this whole Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart situation. So it would almost, in my head, make more sense to be like, Stone Cold just happens to be sitting in the sound booth. Like, okay, yeah, you got Michael's music queued up. Yeah, what button is that again? Okay. I mean, don't get me wrong. I get the tension between Hart and Shawn Michaels. I think it's there. It does feel very real. But it also would make sense to have Stone Cold initiate that to cause them the same type of problems that he's been having. Now, granted, this is in my own head. I don't know that any of this is real, but it would make sense to work it that way, especially because since later on we get Stone Cold coming out and again, chop blocking a leg, this time to Owen Hart. It just, I don't know, some of it makes sense. But the thing that really caught me about this whole situation is that once we get visual on Shawn Michaels and he comes out, he has the scruffy, short trimmed beard. We haven't seen Shawn Michaels like that before. And I think that was an indication of him turning heel officially. And of course, his actions at the very end of the match definitely solidified his heel status and him going heel. So, but I think that's one of those visual cues that WWE does, that 9 times out of 10, your babyface is going to be clean shaven. Your heel is going to have, it's almost like a mask. You know, they're hiding something. They're hiding their kindness. They're hiding their intentions behind a mask. And whether it's paint or whether it's a beard or whether or not it's a full grown beard closer to what you have, Danny, or something shorter crop like Mags has, it's a visual choice to try and trick your brain into, this may not be a good guy. Not saying that you guys aren't good guys. Well, Max isn't. He's terrible. But
wow. Wow. But you do make a good point. One thing I noticed, if I was a fan and a kid back in this era, who am I actually meant to root for in this whole situation? Brett is obviously showing heel-like tendencies, especially with the stuff with Austin recently. You've got Sid, who was a face, and is now with the Jose Lothario stuff, showing heel-like tendencies. You've already made a great point. Shawn Michaels comes out with a beard. He's been a douchebag on commentary. He's a heel. Austin is clearly still a heel, although he's kind of transitioning to that kind of cool heel. And then you get Owen and Bulldog coming out, who are also heels. This was full of heels. There was no real kind of face to cheer for in this match, which for me made it really interesting. But I can see as a fan where you could be confused at what was actually going on.
Definitely. I mean, from there we go to, as you said, the world title match, Bret Hart versus Psycho Sid. Yeah, it's been pretty much covered. I mean, just Shawn Michaels comes out on commentary, just doing Shawn Michaels things. One thing I did like about this match was Bret Hart working the back throughout the entire match to obviously play into his finisher. But as a match, what did you guys think of this?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think one thing that Bret Hart does really well is focus on body parts. Mm-hmm. And we see it all the way through his career that he's so good at singling out a certain body part and really telling a story in a match, even with a wrestler who may be a little bit more rudimentary in terms of technical skill like Sid is. And again, we get that that interference, but kind of like the Mankind match, this makes sense because there were so many kind of roles in play and so many kind of like feuds going on between all the players. It actually made sense for Austin to come out. He's been a douchebag all of the show. He's done the whatever he can to kind of ruin Bret Hart's comeback to the WWF. And then obviously Bulldog still has his issue with him, so it makes sense for that to be going on. But the match is nothing to write home about. Certainly not the best match on the card, and certainly not Brett's best match. But it did what it needed to do. It got Sid out of the show with the towel. It furthered that feud with Brett and Shawn Michaels because obviously Shawn essentially cost him the towel, and it also kind of hints at further feuds. The kind of the power facing that Sid does with Shawn Michaels, and Shawn is eager to get involved if it affects Brett. But he kind of looks like he's scared of Sid. So he's maybe not as willing to get involved in that way. The finish was a little bit silly, I suppose. I mean, but it worked. It kind of added to that feud of Brett and Shawn Michaels. But yeah, I didn't hate the match. It just wasn't the best match on the card.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. You know, it kind of helped to further push storylines. Shawn and Sid, Shawn and Brett, Stone Cold and Brett. Shawn more firmly, especially post-match, the way he's speaking to fans, the way he's acting with fans, it firmly solidified him in that full turn to heel. And so that I appreciated. It kind of drew those lines a little bit clearer, at least for the time being. And I think, you know, we've talked about it before with Sid doing the, you know, what he did in the match to win the title to Jose Lothario. We kind of had is Sid the heel? Because we were trying to make him the heel. And I think they realized at this point, Sid's not going to be a heel, no matter how they try and slice it. You know, the fans want him to be master and commander and ruler of the world, you know, and they're here for that. And so while he can get away, it's kind of a Stone Cold before he was fully encapsulated as Stone Cold. You know, he's the anti-hero type deal where they'll kind of excuse his actions because, you know, they want him to succeed. They want the not so nice bad guy, you know, or not so nice good guy to win. And so it helped to draw those lines in the sand, so to speak, a little bit better. And so I'm kind of with Mags. I didn't hate the match. I didn't love the match. There was a lot of convoluted things going on, but it was okay. It wasn't the best match on the card, I would say, but I think it did what it needed to do.
Yeah, I enjoyed the brawl post-match, though, when especially with Bret Hart pulling Shawn Michaels' shirt over his head, kind of like you would do, like you see in hockey, I suppose, ass hockey, and just laying into him. But yeah, it felt almost Hogan-esque for me that Sid had won the title and he was in the ring celebrating, and who was the focal point? It was Shawn Michaels. It kind of felt very politically motivated to make sure Sean was the guy at the end of the show, not the champion.
Definitely.
Think about it. It's Vince.
Yeah. Oh my
Are we
God,
really
Sean,
that
you're
surprised?
You're so masculine.
Which is so funny because there's always kind of this running, I don't want to say it's a running joke, but it's a running understanding within the wrestling community that Vince likes big guys. And Sean's not that big, you know, in comparison to the quote unquote big guys that we usually see him make champion or put in prominent positions. It's really, really weird. I mean, maybe just because, you know, so many fans were behind him and he was making the money.
Maybe, or maybe there was another reason.
Oh, Jesus, Max.
Well,
let's leave that where it is.
Yes.
Not even on the table. Let's put it on the floor, kick it away.
Well, on that note, we come to an end of the pay-per-view. And I just want to say thank you, everyone, for listening in if you've made it this far. As a pay-per-view itself, though, what would you guys rate this?
I mean, I'm happy to go first because I went into this kind of remembering the bad stuff about this pay-per-view, and we've all seen like how it's been reviewed online and how it gets reviewed in YouTube videos. This is roundly hated by the majority of the wrestling community. But actually sitting and watching it, this was an enjoyable 2 hours of wrestling for me. The interferences were ridiculous. Yes, the Armageddon match was dumb, but I had fun. I enjoyed watching this card. We had some really good wrestling in a couple of matches. We got some continuations of storylines. Yeah, it ticked a lot of boxes. It's not going to be a classic, and I'm not kind of clamoring to watch it again in the near future, but I don't regret watching it.
No, I can say the same. Like, I don't regret watching it, you know, but I can't say that I'd ever go back and watch it again. Mm. That's kind of where I am. It's not one of those that I could go back and rewatch it 100 times. You know, I couldn't even rewatch. I don't even know. The only way I could probably rewatch it is if in a year from now, somebody asked me to come on a podcast and talk about this pay-per-view. And then even then, I've got it all written down in a notebook. So I could probably just go through my notebook real quick.
In other words, you will never watch this again.
Probably not. Probably not. Maybe 5 years from now, I could potentially. No, I'll give it 3 years. I could potentially, if I absolutely had to, yeah, I could watch it again maybe in 3 years. And
Danny,
even then, I'd probably still fast forward.
Will I watch this again? Probably not. But, I mean, there wasn't, as we said in the Survivor Series review, we was thinking what things really stand out. And to me, there was really nothing that stood out apart from that ridiculous looking security group with the Zubaz pants and the blue shirts that look like they look like rejected wrestlers, like just they kind of just look like dropouts. But other than that, no, I don't think I would go back and watch this. But I mean, it wasn't bad, but it's just not what I grew up on. So, but yeah, but on that note, but thank you very much.
I'm glad we get to torment you with this horrific wrestling.
Definitely. One day I'll torment you in the 2005-2006
era. Jesus Christ.
But yep, that's going to end it for us today. Thank you everyone for joining in. And yep, as we do the socials, so where can everyone find you, Mags?
Oh, you can follow me. I mean, I'm pointing because we're actually on a video, but it's going to be audio. But you can follow me on Twitter at PodfatherMax. I'm involved in so many different podcasts, just too many podcasts. I really need to cull my amount. But I cover wrestling,
but you will?
Football.
No.
I'm definitely not going to. No. I'll probably add to it. But I cover wrestling, football, MMA, wherever you hear a podcast, you can hear the dulcet tones of my voice.
And where can we find you, Ori?
You can find me on Twitch, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Ori the Draw.
Brilliant. And also, I will give a shout out to Tanner, who is going to be back really soon, isn't he, Max?
No, I don't know who that is. yeah, he is. Tanner finally getting to the end of completing his move across Texas. So yeah, hopefully he'll be back in the coming weeks. So yeah, we'll hear the Texas gentleman again.
And if you want to torment him and tell him to hurry his butt up, you can catch him at Radio Techers on Twitter or Texas Gentleman _.
You can.
Brilliant. And you can find me on Twitter only at Scottish Juggalo. I may not sound Scottish, but I am. And thank you very much.
The more you have to tell it, the more I don't believe you are. It's like the lady doth protest too much.
Yeah. You're killing my gimmick there. But thank you everyone for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Don't forget to check out all of the shows here on Chairshot Radio Network, such as Lucha Weekly,
Underground.
Lucha Underground Weekly or Lucha Weekly Underground. I'm trying to remember.
It's Lucha Central.
Lucha Central. I would like to formally apologize to Miranda Morales.
The good thing is she doesn't have Twitter. She's the Twitterless heroine. So
that's right.
She can't blast you on the socials.
No, but I do follow her on Instagram. So, I might get an angry
DM.
That's it. I do apologize to the queen of soft style. But you can catch Lucha Central, DWI, Bandwagon Nerds, The Greg DeMarco Show, so many great shows. There's a new show every day. Check it out. And don't forget, you can also go to prowrestlingtees.com/thechairshot and pick up your own Chairshot shirt, including Chairshot 360.
But pay by PayPal. Don't put your details in.
No, do PayPal. Always PayPal. Hoy. Anyway. But thanks for joining us here on Chairshot Radio Network. We will see you next week. And don't forget, guys, always use your head.
Guten Tag.
Bye-bye.
TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com.
expires April 30th. One-time use only, not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.